Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
Happy to have you here. So tomorrow, President Biden is going to be in Virginia campaigning in the governor's race there. Virginia is going to elect a new governor a week from tomorrow. It'll either be Democrat Terry McAuliffe, for whom President Biden is campaigning tomorrow, or it will be Republican Glenn Youngkin, who is endorsed by Donald Trump. Now, polls in Virginia show that as of now, it is a tight race. As a matter of odds and history and statistics, the Democrats really have their work cut out for them in this race. Over the course of my lifetime, and I'm old, I was born in 1973. I know, right? Over the course of my entire life, every time a new president has been elected to the White House, the other party wins the Virginia governor's race the following year. The president, Virginia holds its governor's races in off years and odd years. And so there's always a governor's race after a presidential election, the year after. And it happens every single time that whoever the new president is who just won the presidency, the other party then wins in Virginia. Every single time. When I was three, Jimmy Carter won the presidency in 1976, a Democrat, obviously. Then in 1977, a Republican wins for Virginia governor. Then in 1980, it was Ronald Reagan who won the presidency, obviously a Republican. And so in 1981, it was a Democrat who won the Virginia governor the following year. It happens every time. When George H.W. Bush won in 88 as a Republican, Democrat won the governorship in Virginia. When Clinton won in 92 as a Democrat, Virginia governor's race went to a Republican in 93. When George W. Bush, a Republican, won in 2000, a Democrat won the Virginia governorship the following year. After Obama won in 2008, that's how we got Republican Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell in 2009. After Trump won in 2016, we got Democrat Ralph Northam elected governor in Virginia in 2017. It is uncanny. Every single time since I have been alive, it has gone this way. And since we just got a newly elected Democratic president last year, if Virginia holds to this long-established pattern, then the Republicans are, you know, cast by the fate as the likely victors in this year's Virginia governor's race. That is, you know, if you follow the odds, if you follow the history here, history would say that the Republicans have an edge. That said, this year the Republicans have picked a Trump guy as their candidate. They didn't have to. But they did. They picked a Trump-endorsed candidate right after Trump just lost Virginia by more than 10 points. This weekend, the Washington Post editorial board, obviously their home readership includes a lot of Virginia, the Post editorial board this weekend just stripped the proverbial hide off of Republican Virginia candidate Glenn Youngkin. It's the kind of election eve editorial you really don't expect from that particular editorial page, but oh my God, did they not hold back? Quote, next month's elections in Virginia, next week's elections in Virginia coincide with a singular moment in U.S. history in which one major party has turned against accepting the results of free and fair elections. That momentous juncture poses a character test for all Republicans, which turns on this question. Will they stand against the assault on democracy's most basic precept, or will they tolerate it? The GOP gubernatorial nominee in Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, has failed that character test. A wealthy private equity executive turned political newcomer, Mr. Youngkin has indulged and encouraged Republicans who have swallowed former President Donald Trump's lie that last year's presidential election was stolen and that American elections are not to be trusted. Few stances could be more subversive to the American experiment or more corrosive to our pluralistic system's fundamental legitimacy. Few shine so bright a spotlight on a candidate's courage and commitment to the Constitution, or lack thereof. Quote, it seems likely that Mr. Youngkin knows that U.S. elections, including last year's presidential contest, have been largely free of any significant fraud or cheating, and that to suggest otherwise is flat-out dishonesty. Nonetheless, for months, as he sought the gubernatorial nomination, and while Mr. Trump promoted those lies and refused to concede the results of the election, Youngkin refused to acknowledge that President Biden was fairly elected, or that allegations that the 2020 election was stolen were baseless allegations. To the contrary, during those months, Mr. Youngkin's number one policy proposal, and the only one for which he supplied any detail, was to establish a state commission on election integrity, an idea that winked at the prevalent and baseless idea among Republicans that elections are fraudulent. He dodged a question about whether, had he been in Congress, he would have certified Mr. Biden's election. Unsolicited, he raised questions about whether Virginia's voting machines can be trusted and insisted that they be audited, which they already are. He attended an election integrity rally at Liberty University in Lynchburg. When asked by a hopeful Republican voter whether the courts might reverse the 2020 election results, Youngkin dodged, saying that courts move slowly and it's, quote, unclear whether they might reinstall Donald Trump as president. The Post concludes, quote, this is not an everyday campaign dispute. We might disagree with Mr. Youngkin on, say, Medicaid expansion, without arguing that his stance is disqualifying. But at a moment when democracy itself is under assault, Glenn Youngkin chose to dignify a fundamental fiction that is subverting our system rather than stand up squarely for the truth. In so doing, he proved himself unfit for office. End. End of the editorial. That's the Washington Post this weekend, calmly but completely eviscerating the Republican who is running for governor next week in Virginia. I mean, it's one thing for the paper to say, like, we prefer this one candidate over the other. It's another thing to say, yeah, one of these two guys is unfit for office. There was a test of character in this race. He has failed it. As we head toward that very important governor's race next week, again, the history doesn't favor the Democrats here. The polls show it's very tight. That said, they're running this Trumpy guy. Trump just lost Virginia by 10 points. It's going to be a very, very close contest if the polls are right. It's going to be fascinating to watch. It's obviously really consequential. But this is also worth watching as we head toward Election Day in Virginia. The Democratic Party of Virginia has just filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Postal Service, accusing the post office of a failure to process and deliver election-related mail in a timely manner, potentially leading to the disenfranchisement of Virginians seeking to cast absentee ballots in the statewide Virginia election on November 2nd. They're asking the court to order the post office to prioritize and expedite election-related mail ahead of next week's election. The party singles out three counties, all of which voted for Biden over Trump, where they say they have particular concerns about unscanned, unprocessed election materials piling up. Now, I should just mention here that the post office is kind of having a minute right now. The guy who was appointed under Trump to run the post office, his name is Louis DeJoy. He is still in charge, even though he is personally under FBI federal criminal investigation. On top of that, last week, NBC News reported on new documents that were obtained by court order, which show that Louis DeJoy's conflicts of interest are way worse than what was previously known. We knew already that his old company, which he still financially benefits from, his company got a $120 million contract from the post office last year while he's running the post office and while he still benefits financially from that company that he just gave a $120 million contract to. Wait a minute. But beyond that, even, he has had a financial stake in 13 other major companies that have been doing business with the post office while he's been running the post office. And, like, it's not subtle. Last year, J.P. Morgan Chase announced that for months, it had been in talks with the post office about potentially putting Chase Bank ATMs in post office lobbies across the country. That's nice. That's nice for Chase Bank. Particularly nice for the head of the post office, Louis DeJoy, who at the time of those talks had a large personal financial stake in J.P. Morgan Chase. Oh, really? All that on top of him promising to increase the cost of sending mail this year, specifically for the Christmas season. Right? Tis the season. Everybody likes to mail things for Christmas, so he's going to give the American people a special Christmas present this year of specially hiked postal rates just for Christmas. And that's on top of the new plan he has just started implementing to make the U.S. mail service permanently slower and permanently more expensive. Except apparently for Christmas, when he's making it even more expensive than that. Happy Mary. Happy Mary. Mary happy. Enjoy the holiday. And now he stands accused in federal court in Virginia of so screwing up the mail that it potentially is going to mess up yet another election. According to the Democratic Party of Virginia, this lawsuit they've just filed, unscanned, unprocessed election mail piling up in particular in three Democratic-leaning counties that Biden won last year, and this just 8 days before the election in Virginia. Thank you, Louis DeJoy, doing a great job. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, but it is not this guy. Here's the other thing, though, that's going on in Virginia that is worth paying attention to, both in its own right, but also because this is going to be a blockbuster thing that is going to be unfolding in a very high-profile way in Virginia this week and into next and beyond, just as Virginia voters are going to the polls in this super important, tight election. It is now just over 4 years since a rotten assortment, if you'll forgive me, of neo-Nazis and white supremacists and anti-Semites convened in Charlottesville, Virginia, to basically terrorize that town and the University of Virginia campus. This was the, you know, Jews will not replace us torch-lit march. The guys with rifles and pistols and clubs and chemical spray and swastika flags marching through Charlottesville, surrounding the only synagogue in Charlottesville, assaulting counter-protesters. Ultimately, one of their number, an avowed neo-Nazi, rammed his car at high speed into a group of counter-protesters, killing one of them, a young woman named Heather Heyer, injuring at least 19 other people, some of them quite severely. The guy who deliberately drove that car into that crowd is now facing not one, but two life sentences without the possibility of parole, plus another 419 years on top of that for good measure. But just days after the debacle in Charlottesville, a very interesting legal strategy started to come together to try to pursue some accountability, not just for that murderer, now convicted murderer, but for the neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups that didn't just plan to come to Charlottesville to speak their minds. They planned the violence there. And we know that in part because of leaked screenshots of these guys planning and promoting the Charlottesville event online. Interactions online which showed them promising and hyping and celebrating that it would be violent in Charlottesville, that the violence would specifically target Jewish people and people of color. Quote, there is an atavistic rage in us, deep in us, that is ready to boil over. There is a craving to return to an age of violence. We want a war. That's in advance of the Charlottesville event. And quote, if you want to defend the South and Western civilization from the Jew and his dark-skinned allies, be at Charlottesville on 12th of August. Also this one. Next stop, Charlottesville, Virginia. Final stop, Auschwitz. They exchanged these fantasies and plans about fighting with and doing violence to Jewish people and black people and people of color. They exchanged fantasies and plans about driving vehicles into protesters, which is, of course, exactly what happened. As one extremism expert at Cal State San Bernardino just told NBC News about this case, quote, we have to tolerate bigotry in the marketplace of ideas because of the First Amendment. But when that bigotry turns into conspiratorial violence, there is redress. Well, the redress that is being sought here is by nine plaintiffs who were harmed by what happened in Charlottesville, including a minister who was assaulted by the neo-Nazis, four people who were injured in the car attack that killed Heather Heyer, a Jewish woman who was hounded and stalked by these anti-Semitic thugs. Their case is spearheaded by a group called Integrity First for America, and they brought this suit on behalf of these nine plaintiffs against a big, broad swath of defendants, 14 individuals and 10 groups, all far-right white nationalist, white supremacist, neo-Nazi extremist groups and individuals, all involved in the planning and executing of the Charlottesville event. This is the trial that is just starting right now in Charlottesville, just a week ahead of Virginia choosing its next governor. The case in Charlottesville went to jury selection starting today. The trial is expected to run for the next 4 weeks or so. But it's already proving to be sort of a nightmare for the planners of what happened in Charlottesville. Here, for example, is the headline on this case today, on this case recently at USA Today. Lawsuit over Charlottesville Unite the Right rally has crippled white supremacist groups and leaders. Quote, a federal lawsuit against the organizers of the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, has rattled hate groups and white supremacist leaders. The suit already has helped to dismantle some of America's most well-known white supremacist groups, and it has financially crippled one leader of the so-called alt-right, the white supremacist and nationalist movement that came to prominence under President Donald Trump. Richard Spencer, one of the defendants in the lawsuit, said, quote, it's very stressful and very costly. Spencer acknowledged that the Integrity First lawsuit has taken a toll, along with the constant stress. The lawsuit, he says, has cost thousands of dollars to defend. In June 2020, Richard Spencer told the court that the case has been, quote, financially crippling. Now he is representing himself in court. Did you say he's representing himself? Serving as his own lawyer? You don't say. Whatever else has happened in your life today, I bequeath you this. A little warm fuzziness to hold in your heart. The Nazis are representing themselves in court, acting as their own lawyers. That always works out great. Good for them. Couldn't happen to a nicer bunch. That one, Richard Spencer, is representing himself in court because his other lawyers stopped repping him when he stopped paying them. Another of the defendants lost his lawyers when they quit because he started spewing anti-Semitic threats against one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs. Three of the defendants have managed to hold on to their lawyer, but their lawyer is a gentleman from Ohio who says he's representing these three clients out of the goodness of his heart because he agrees with them, because he himself wants to, quote, oppose Jewish influence in society. And so he has taken their case, and that's why I'm sure he's going to be a great lawyer. Sounds like he's got mad skills, emphasis on mad. At least two of the defendants in this case have gone into hiding. Seven of the defendants have already had a default judgment levied against them by the court. It's basically the civil suit equivalent of a guilty plea arranged on their behalf by the court after they ignored court orders, refused to comply with them. They've had default judgments levied against them already. One of them, the leader of the National Socialist Movement, where have I heard that name before? He tried to say he didn't need to comply with court orders because he dropped his phone in the toilet. Accident? It was an accident. There it went, plop, in the toilet. So to his mind, that meant he didn't need to respond to the court anymore or produce any documents demanded by court order. You will be surprised to learn that the court disagreed. Oops, I dropped it in the toilet isn't a legal defense to compulsory proceedings. So seven of these guys have already lost the case already by default judgment. Three of them are facing fines over $10,000 already as sanctions from the court. And did I mention they're only at the point of jury selection? That thing hasn't even gotten started yet. The point of this litigation overtly is to bankrupt the neo-Nazis and white supremacists, the individual leaders and the organizations who made Charlottesville happen, who promised that it would be used as an occasion to bring violence in the name of white supremacy and to terrorize Black and Jewish people. That's what they did Charlottesville for. That's how they overtly planned it. And that is how they carried it out. Holding them accountable for it by a civil lawsuit is an unusual thing in this day and age, but it has already succeeded partially in taking them apart. And I say this tactic is rarely used, but it is not never used. If this tactic sounds familiar to you as a viewer of this show, it may be that you're remembering a story we covered here in 2019, the story of a brave, accomplished young woman. Her name is Taylor Dumpson. In 2017, Taylor Dumpson was elected student body president by her peers at American University in Washington, D.C. She's the first ever African-American woman elected to be student body president there. In response, somebody hung nooses nooses, and bunches of bananas for the extra racist kick all over the campus of American University. And after there was some publicity about that, a prominent neo-Nazi website run by one of the defendants in the Charlottesville case, incidentally, that prominent neo-Nazi website took up the case, so to speak, and they doxed her. They posted her personal information online, and they encouraged the monsters who frequent that neo-Nazi website that they should step up the attacks on her. Keep it going, and worse. What would you do in that circumstance, having every avowed neo-Nazi in the internet coming for you after those physical threats already? Well, she responded by going on offense. She brought a case led by the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Her case was helmed by a very, 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 very able lawyer named Kristen Clark, who we had here on the show to talk about it at the time. Kristen Clark, you may remember, you may recognize. She is now the head of the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice. Appointed by President Biden, she now serves there under Attorney General Merrick Garland. But the young woman who brought that case, the civil case in which she sued the living daylights out of the neo-Nazis who organized these attacks on her, her case was successful. She won a large monetary judgment against the Nazi who ran that website that orchestrated those attacks. She herself has since graduated from American University. She then went on to graduate from Cardozo School of Law. She has now joined the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, the same organization that represented her and won her case against that neo-Nazi website in 2019. Taylor Dumpson now works as a civil rights attorney. Earlier today, she spoke about her case at the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division's virtual conference on confronting hate. But Taylor Dumpson joins us now live. She's a presidential fellow at the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Ms. Dumpson, it's a real honor to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel.
So let me start, first of all, by asking if I got any of that wrong, and also by asking how you're doing. I imagine this has been just an incredible inflection point, turning point in your life. It seems to have set you off on the path that you're on now.
Absolutely. The hate crime, to say the least, definitely changed my life, and the cyber harassment that ensued afterwards continued to do so. I'm definitely one of the lucky ones. I'm one of the people who have survived. I take it as an obligation and a responsibility to share my story because, unlike Heather Heyer, I'm able to share my story as my own person and on my own behalf. Luckily, Heather has her mother, Susan Breaux, and other folks around there to advocate on her behalf. But as a survivor and as one of the lucky ones, I'm here to share my story.
What should we understand? I mean, obviously, you're now a practicing civil rights lawyer yourself. You've been through this process through a very unusual circumstance, given what you went through. But what should we understand? What should the country understand about this strategy, about using civil litigation, in which the victim is the plaintiff, goes after the perpetrators here through civil litigation, basically to try to bankrupt them, to make them literally pay for what they've done? How should we understand that in terms of its overall effectiveness against these kinds of crimes or these kinds of this kind of behavior, but also what kind of difference it makes to victims?
Absolutely. So civil litigation is just one of the many tools available to survivors of hate incidents and hate crimes to be able to bring their perpetrators to accountability. In my suit, we were able to sue three of the individuals who cyber harassed me online, as well as the Daily Stormwish parent company. And there we were using a novel kind of idea using public accommodations as that avenue. And so basically, you're not allowed to discriminate against people because of their places of public accommodations like schools and hospitals and other places like that that are accessible to the public. And so being able to use litigation and civil remedies as an avenue for people to be able to hold their perpetrators accountable is just one of the ways. And so being able to see what the lawyers are doing in Science versus Kessler, the Charlottesville litigation, is just really amazing.
Yeah. Are you encouraged by what's happening in Charlottesville? I mean, one of the things that's unique about that case is that there is such a broad swath of defendants. They're not going after, a single entity, a single defendant who had a key role in organizing those things. It is a murderer's row of neo-Nazi leaders, white supremacist organizers, and the organizations that they've been able to cobble together over the years. Obviously, if this litigation is successful, it's going to be a death blow to a lot of those groups because they'll never be able to have a dollar to their names. What do you make about that as a sort of that sort of broad strategy they're taking on that whole movement all at once?
I think it's sending a very strong signal to folks in that movement that survivors will speak out, survivors will use their voices, and they will use every avenue available to them, including litigation, to hold folks like this accountable. And so luckily, defendants like Andrew Anglin are basically been forced into the shadows because of litigation, like the case that I was able to bring, like the case that's being brought right now, and like some of the other cases that have been levied against them. And so I hope that this is a fatal blow to their movement and people know that, you know, survivors will continue to use their voices.
Taylor Dumpson, an attorney and presidential fellow with the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, with a remarkable story of her own to how she ended up there. Ms. Dumpson, thank you. Good luck to you. And thanks for being with us tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right. We've got much more ahead here tonight. Senator Elizabeth Warren is going to be joining us in just a moment. Stay with us.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
When citizens in St. Petersburg, in Russia, went to vote last month, the ballots included the name Boris Vishnevsky. And then again, on a different line, Boris Vishnevsky. And then again, on a third different line, there he was again, Boris Vishnevsky. Same name was on the ballot three times, but it was three different dudes. One of the Borises was a legitimate Russian opposition candidate running to take a seat from Putin's party, basically. The other two Borises were dudes who literally had their names changed to Boris Vishnevsky, just to be confusing. Both of them even mimicked his appearance so as to doubly confuse voters as to who the real Boris Vishnevsky really was. Going to those lengths essentially ensured that voters in St. Petersburg wouldn't be able to tell who the real guy was. Votes for the real Boris Vishnevsky would be split, making it easier for the Kremlin-aligned pro-Putin opponent to win because the real opposition candidate, well, nobody could figure out which one he was. That is just one of the next-level, totally crazy election manipulation techniques from the Putin government in this most recent Russian election. They'll do basically anything. Nothing is too outlandish. Nothing is too humiliating to keep Russians from voting for anyone other than Putin's party or Putin's chosen candidates. They play dirty. And so opposition leaders have decided they need to play smart. Case in point, a smart voting app designed by allies of Russia's most potent opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. The idea behind the smart voting thing was that because the deck is so stacked against opposition candidates in Russia, all the opposing parties should team up and vote tactically. Everybody should join together, put all their other differences aside, and in each district where there was voting, they should coalesce around a single candidate who could beat the Putin candidate. So if you were a Russian citizen voting in this last election, you'd download this app, enter your zip code, and you would then be told by the app which opposition candidate in your district had the best chances of taking down a member of Putin's party. That smart voting app, that whole idea was such a big threat to Putin and his party that just days before their national election last month, the Russian government started harassing Google and Apple, literally threatening to prosecute Russia-based employees of those companies if Google and Apple didn't pull the app from their app stores. And Google and Apple said, sure, okay, no problem. They caved. Right before the election, the companies pulled the app from their platforms, letting the Russian government have even more control over their already rigged elections and kneecapping the opposition in their best effort, their best hope to finally stand up candidates against Putin's party. Google went one step further. They also blocked Navalny's YouTube videos. They blocked YouTube videos that Navalny and his allies had posted to help coordinate this opposition voting, this smart voting strategy. Google blocked those videos. Again, at the request, at the demand of Putin's government. Today, the Washington Post published an eerily resonant story along those same lines, except this time it involves the CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, and the nation of Vietnam. Here's how they put it. Quote, late last year, Mark Zuckerberg faced a choice. Comply with demands from Vietnam's ruling Communist Party to censor anti-government dissidents, or risk getting knocked offline in one of Facebook's most lucrative Asian markets. And so in the months leading up to Vietnam's process for choosing new political leaders in January, quote, Facebook significantly increased censorship of anti-state posts, giving the government in Vietnam near total control over the platform, according to local activists and free speech advocates. That decision and Mark Zuckerberg's reportedly personal involvement in it, that is just one of the mounting revelations that has come out of what's being called the Facebook Papers, a trove of documents provided by a Facebook whistleblower to a consortium of news outlets around the world. It's been making headlines all weekend and into today. There's dozens of stories that have derived from these documents, dozens of stories in multiple news outlets nationwide and worldwide. And I'm sure we're going to get a lot more stories out of these documents in coming days. But one of the more harrowing pictures that is starting to form already revolves around what appears to be a fairly routine test that Facebook does to see where its algorithm is leading its users. In the summer of 2019, a researcher at Facebook made a dummy account, a fake account for a person named Carol Smith. This fake Carol Smith persona was set up sort of generically. A politically conservative mom from North Carolina, from Wilmington, North Carolina. She expressed in her Facebook profile, as she signed up, an interest in politics and parenting and Christianity. And she followed just a few other Facebook accounts, including Fox News and President Trump. And that's it. It's just sort of a bare bones profile. And this fake account, this Carol Smith account, never expressed any interest in conspiracy theories of any kind. But nevertheless, it only took 2 days before Facebook recommended that that person, Carol Smith, should join groups dedicated to QAnon, the conspiracy theory that holds that Democrats are a secret cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles that drink children's blood and they're all going to end up getting executed in a mass public execution at Guantanamo. Really? Carol, so soon? Then, even though the researcher running that fake account did not engage with those groups, with those recommendations to join the QAnon groups, within a week, Carol Smith's feed was filled with groups and pages that violated Facebook's own rules because they were filled with hate speech and disinformation. That researcher published the story of that dummy account's journey in a 2019 internal report at Facebook called Carol's Journey to QAnon. But even after that was found and reported inside Facebook by their own researchers, nothing happened. At least not a lot happened that we can tell. And that was not a standalone incident. An incredibly similar thing happened with a dummy account set up in India in 2019. Instead of a conservative mom being told to go full QAnon, though, in this case, the dummy account was a 21-year-old Indian woman set up as a generic account without expressing much interest in anything, very quickly being flooded with quite disgusting, quite lurid, anti-Muslim hate speech and propaganda. The Facebook researcher who built that account said, quote, this test user's newsfeed has become a near constant barrage of polarizing nationalist content, misinformation, violence, and gore. Again, just by following Facebook's recommendations. Now, in response to these test cases, Facebook has pointed to changes it says it made to make the platform safer. It also says it has made progress in working to stop abuse. in countries where there's a heightened risk of conflict and violence. But it's clear that the problems that tech giants like Facebook are both facing and creating are complex, but are also really, really not getting better over time. And if we are looking to these companies to show bravery and backbone, so far the evidence that they are capable of that or inclined in that way is getting worse over time. Worse over time and seemingly acutely worse recently. How do we solve for that? And who is in charge of solving for that? Senator Elizabeth Warren joins us about that and more next.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
This was a paid advertisement that ran on Facebook in October of 2019. It says, quote, "Breaking news. Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook just endorsed Donald Trump for re-election. You're probably shocked. You might be thinking, how could this possibly be true?" It was not true. Neither Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg nor the company he runs offered any kind of public political endorsement of any of the candidates in 2020 from either party. But there it was, in black and white, in a Facebook ad on Mark Zuckerberg's own platform, claiming that he had made this endorsement that he hadn't really made. Here was it showing up, nevertheless, being seen by thousands and thousands and thousands of people, even though it was false. The reason this ad was allowed to stay up on Facebook was because it was paid for by Elizabeth Warren and her presidential campaign. According to Facebook's own rules, that essentially gave her a free pass to lie as much as she wanted, to say whatever she wanted on Facebook's platform as long as it was part of a paid political ad for her campaign. Ahead of the 2020 presidential campaign, Facebook announced that any ad paid for by a political candidate would be exempt from Facebook's fact-checking protocols. The practical implication of that is exactly what you think. Politicians were formally allowed on Facebook to spread any lie they wanted about their opponents with total impunity. That, for example, is how Donald Trump was allowed to run Facebook ads falsely accusing Joe Biden of corruption. With her deliberately transparently false ads, Senator Warren set out not only to test the system, but also to demonstrate how dangerous Facebook could be, with only stupid rules in place, without proper safeguards in place to make sure that they weren't just spreading known base lies. That was just in response to the policies at Facebook we knew about publicly. As we now start to learn more about how Facebook operated behind the scenes, about how the company's own recommendations and internal incentives steer everyday people to violence and conspiracies and hate all over the world, now that we know about it, what are we supposed to do to address it? Joining us now is Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts. Senator Warren, it's really nice to see you. Thank you so much for making time to be here.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So you drilled down on this issue so specifically in the 2020 campaign, in 2019. I'm wondering, given all the new information we have just learned about this stuff from the Facebook whistleblower, what sticks out to you right now as the most important thing to focus on?
2 years ago, I really thought we needed to break up Facebook. Today, I really, really, really think we need to break up Facebook. And think of it this way. You know, you have a telephone. I have a telephone. We may use different telephone companies, but we can call each other. We could make that work with all of the postings you want to do, all the social media you want to do. But the reason we need to break up Facebook is that it's critically important that there not be one worldwide company that basically has all of the information from everyone. Because they have made it clear, What they care about first, second, and third is profits, profits, profits. And if that means doing the dance with dictators, if that means telling Donald Trump or Elizabeth Warren you could run ads that lie about your opponents, then they're fine with that as long as they keep raking the bucks in. And they're so damn good at it because they have so much information about everyone. So my view on this is it is time to break up Facebook now.
Is it any more likely that that will happen now than it was in 2019 when you were so vocal about it just a couple of years ago?
Yes. We now have a head of the FTC who has written about the dangers that this kind of monopoly poses to our country. And understand, it's an economic monopoly. You want to buy an ad on Facebook? You know who you go to? You go to Facebook. You go to the dealers. Every part of this is controlled by Facebook. The pricing, the buyers, the sellers, every part of it. But the other part is that they understand the political risks that a company like this threatens. Also, we now have someone in the Justice Department who has shown that he has the courage to stand up to monopolists like Facebook. So I'm really encouraged. We have good laws. I'd like to strengthen them, but we have good laws on the books, and we have people who I believe are going to be willing to pick up those laws and start using them. It'll be a tough fight, but my money's on them.
In terms of getting to the kind of goal that you're talking about, whether or not the breakup of Facebook ultimately happens, and I hear you when you describe why it's more likely than it previously was, is there a room for the Congress, essentially, to establish regulation in this field around human rights and around the protections for pluralistic democracies? I mean, if Facebook had been compelled by U.S. law to not respond to a dictator, to not respond to the Putin regime in Russia and take actions to disadvantage opposition political candidates, if they were constrained by U.S. law in terms of how they were able to answer demands like that, would that make a difference?
Sure. We could have written much better laws over the last decade to be able to constrain. Now, it's tough. You know, we've got lots of free speech issues, and the regulation would be difficult. There's no doubt about it. But yes, we could have done better. But, Rachel, that's the reminder about what's wrong with monopolies. It's not only what they're doing out in the marketplace. It's what they're doing to Washington. It's how much power Facebook and its lobbyists have in Washington. And they're the ones who keep Congress from acting. You know, the reason Congress doesn't act is because millions of users across the country are saying, oh, please, you know, don't make life a little tougher for Facebook. I don't want to have the option of picking from 8 or 10 or 20 different companies that are competing for my business. I only want to go to Facebook. That's not the reason at all. It's the concentrated power. Remember that when Teddy Roosevelt, remember the famous trust buster, came in and started breaking up those giant companies around the turn of the last century, the reason he gave was not just about economic power, it was concentrated political power. He did it, he said, to save our democracy. Well, it's come to us again. We need to break up Facebook to save our democracy.
Senator Warren, while you're here, I would be remiss if I did not ask you about the reporting in the Washington Post over this weekend that you've been sort of huddling with Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who's been, forgive me, sort of one of the reasons we don't have major progress in the Senate and therefore in the country on President Biden's agenda. Can you tell us anything about what Senator Sinema is willing to talk to you about and where she might be in terms of how this is going to resolve?
So, look, I'm not going to talk about private conversations, but what I will say is that as Democrats, it is important for us not only to have a package of the things we want to get done, like universal childcare and universal preschool and expanded health care and fighting back against climate change, but also that we pay for it in a way that helps unrig the system at least a little bit. And sure, I'd like to see us raise corporate rates, raise individual rates, But that's still not going to solve some of the key problems. Right now, billionaire individuals and billionaire profitable corporations are paying either little or nothing in taxes, and that is wrong. So we have an opportunity right now to do a billionaire's tax for, yeah, Jeff Bezos, I'm looking at you, these guys who declare $83,000 in income and, of course, control billions of dollars in assets, and companies like Amazon that declare $10 million in profits publicly and pay nothing in taxes. If we come in and do a tax on the fewer than 700 billionaires we've got, and we do it based not on their income, we got to do it based on what they own, and we do a minimum corporate tax, we can not only help fund a lot of that child care and climate change fight that we need to fund, we can also help make the system a little fairer. So we got some possibilities here.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts. It's great to see you, Senator. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you.
All right. We'll be right back. Stay with us. A late-breaking twist in the news tonight. It's about elections. The Biden administration apparently choosing its new top official to keep future elections free of foreign and domestic interference. This is a job that has had some attention, particularly in 2020. This is the Homeland Security's election security chief at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, better known as CISA. And CNN is reporting tonight that the administration is expected to name to that job a woman named Kim Wyman. Now, Kim Wyman is the current Secretary of State in Washington State. She has been in that job since 2013. Again, she is expected to be named President Biden's choice to be the election security lead at Homeland Security. Now, the really interesting news here is that Kim Wyman is a Republican. But as a Republican Secretary of State, she has publicly pushed back against Donald Trump's false election fraud claims about 2020. She's also been very critical of the weird partisan cyber ninjas election thing in Arizona. But this is an interesting twist. Biden puts a sane Republican in charge of national election security. Watch this space. All right, that is going to do it for us tonight. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.